So I feel like all of them have sacrifices that you make. All of them have pros and cons and pros. So polarizing, it is polarizing, but I think people aren't as like judgmental maybe of somebody who has a different opinion or a different way of educating their children.
Unless we experience that someone thinks the way we're doing it is wrong. I think that's where I've seen,
Okay.
yeah, but,
Yes.
you know,
Yeah.
but.
I was going to say, I think that maybe the most polarizing part of it is that I think as parents, we all want to feel like we're doing the right thing and the best thing, right? Like
Yeah.
we're like we
Welcome to How I See It with me, Mark Pratt, and
Justin Sternberg. This is a podcast that works to counter cultural polarization through thoughtful conversations. So, are we ready to do this?
yeah.
All right.
Morning,
You're ready to
Justin.
do it?
Morning, Mark.
Ready to do it.
Morning, ladies.
Who are
Good
these
morning.
ladies? Should we introduce
Well,
them or should we ask them to introduce
I
themselves?
think they can Would is be okay to introduce yourselves?
I think
Certainly.
so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Go
go
ahead,
for
Kelly.
it.
You go first. All right. So I am Kelly Perry. I happen to be Justin's sister-in-law. You may have heard of me from previous podcasts. I'm
That's
sort of
right.
podcast famous, I feel.
There you go. I have
And
no doubt.
so yes.
You may know her as Smelly, maybe.
Yes, or Kelly Belly.
Kelly Bell.
I've had a person that did not know me by that name call me Kelly Belly about a week or two ago, and I was like, oh, okay. So this is happening.
This
So
is real.
yes, I live in Southport with my husband, Jackson, and we have four kids. Raleigh is 7, Lenore is 5, Walter is 3, and Gibson is 1. So that's me.
Nice.
Thanks.
And you?
And we love Kelly.
Yes.
Who's
Thank
we?
you. Our family loves Kelly.
Yeah.
Well, I love Kelly.
So who are you, Mrs. P?
I am Chris. I am Mark's wife,
Yes,
mother
indeed.
to John and Elizabeth. Kelly and I actually used to be co-workers, so we did work together at Generations Church and with Children's Ministry, so we have a fun history together. I am currently a teacher at Southport Christian School, but I have taught in public school. I have taught little people. I've taught high school, middle schoolers. And so we're glad to be here.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a great segue,
Yes, it
Chris,
is.
because we today are going to talk about we kind of talked about it being about early education, but really we anticipate the conversation going as far up as you care to. But I know both of you have a lot of experience with early education, right? In some form or another. And as you briefly mentioned, you know, doing ministry with Kelly at Generations Church. Kelly, you want to share a little bit more about like kind of what got you passionate about the topic of early education? And when I say passionate, I mean if you've ever seen Kelly in the treehouse at Generations Church, you see that passion come through as she's jumping all over the place, you know, doing crazy antics. So, yeah. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, so Treehouse, just if you don't know, Generation Church has an elementary age program, so it's kindergarten through fifth grade. And I actually started serving there when I was like 12, and so from that age, I already knew like I loved to just be in there and experience kids learning and growing. It was just really cool to see like light bulb moments and all that was really exciting. Fast forward to after we got married, we moved to Texas and ended up working in ministry there. And we were in that same kind of role, an elementary age program that we were leading, my husband and I. And so that was always just something that we loved. I love watching kids grow and learn and so now we moved back here to North Carolina, worked with Chris, ran the treehouse for several years and loved that so much. It was a great season. And then ended up stepping back from that so I could focus on my children. And now I'm actually homeschooling my girls and my boys too, but you know, they're pretty young. But Walter thinks he does school. So
Cool.
yeah, so and now I get to kind of see it from the perspective of, you know, a parent and teaching my children is super sweet. And my husband Jackson's actually also a public school teacher, so we kind of have that side of things too.
Yeah.
So
as you think about, as we talk about this educational dynamic and the diversity of it, from your lady's opinion, what makes education such a polarizing topic? If you stop and think about it, as far as, you know, homeschool, public education, you know, church setting, not, you know, speak to us from what you see makes education a difficult topic sometimes for people to talk about.
And even if that's like kind of a obtuse or like out there concept, what makes doing your jobs hard because of how viewpoints differ from your own? Like, that might be a good way to think about it in terms of polarizing, but you might already have an answer.
When I think of polarizing, I do think of like people having very strong opinions about their way of doing things. And I would say education isn't maybe as polarizing as some other topics y'all have talked about. I think people are open and accepting to the way other people do things, even though it's not exactly the same way they do it. So I mean, there's so many ways you can educate your children now, from, you know, homeschooling to charter schools to private schools to public school. So it's great that we have all of those options available to us. But
which one is the wrong answer, so we know to avoid that one?
Yeah. yeah. So there's pros and cons to all of them, right? Which is what makes it really hard for a parent, I think, to make a decision or to go through the process of decision making, because there are pros and cons. And, you know, when I talk to friends who are kind of going through that decision making process, I often say there's a sacrifice to all of it. Like, if you if you choose to homeschool, you're going to sacrifice a part of your financial security, maybe, that one parent has to stay home. On the other end, if you send your kids to public school, you're sacrificing that time that you would be spending with your children so in depth and just that deep relationship. So I feel like all of them have sacrifices that you make. All of them have pros and cons and pros. So polarizing, it is polarizing, but I think people aren't as like judgmental maybe of somebody who has a different opinion or a different way of educating their children.
Unless we experience that someone thinks the way we're doing it is wrong. I think that's where I've seen you know. But
I was going to say, I think that maybe the most polarizing part of it is that I think as parents, we all want to feel like we're doing the right thing and the best thing, right? Like, we're like, so say I'm, you know, a homeschool parent, you know, talking to a public school parent, and I feel like sometimes there's like this, oh, you think you're doing the best thing, and let me try to like explain why. Well, no, I think I'm doing the best thing, you know, and I think that that can be, I mean, it definitely can be polarizing. It can be like, okay, so you're on that side and I'm on this side. And I always try to make sure people feel like, we homeschool, yes, but that's not because I think public school is from the devil. And you know what I mean? Like, but I think sometimes people get that from me. Like, people feel like, oh, she thinks she's a little bit better because she's doing all this stuff with her kids, you know? And then even in the homeschool world, which is the world that I'm in right now, like, I feel like there's all these levels of like how people do it, and oh, you do that, oh, you use that curriculum. And so I think that can be kind of a big thing too. And yeah, so I definitely think it can be polarizing, but I also agree with Chris. I think that for the most part, people do support each other in it, and everybody's got to do different things for what works for their kids and for their family's culture and all that too.
I will say, I think there's stereotypes that people have of each of those categories, and that's what feels really uncomfortable, I think. So we did homeschool. I will say Mark homeschooled. So I was teaching at the time. Mark was going back doing online education for his degree.
So you were doing your own homeschool.
Yeah, I was.
Did Chris teach you as well?
So many things.
It was an interesting era for us because Mark was the homeschooler. I wanted to be the homeschooler, but I was working at Southport Elementary at the time. So anyway, the kids ended up going back to, John went back in eighth grade. Like, yep. He was homeschooled from sixth to eighth.
Yeah.
And so when he decided to go back, of course they needed to place him.
So where's back?
Back to public school.
Public school, okay.
So he went to South Brunswick Middle School. And so immediately when they said, tell us your experience, he said homeschooled. They're like, oh, well, he's not going to be placed in any of the gifted classes or the classes that were ahead because homeschoolers are not usually on track, right? They're usually laid back and they, you know, so we're not going to. It's like, so we had to really advocate that, okay, he can handle this. Test him as much as you want to test him. He's able. And so he did end up, you know, proving himself. But the automatic stereotype was homeschoolers aren't quite as on level as they should be. Because there are some, you know, in the spectrum of homeschooling parents.
Yes.
There are some homeschool parents who don't take it seriously. And it's more of a lifestyle choice that they can just have this freedom to, you know, not have the... have to be to school every day, and you know, so you know, you kind of have to work against those stereotypes.
And you could see how if someone's making that transition right back to the public school from homeschool, how maybe the percentage of not being on the level might make sense because it's like, yeah, we're giving up on this, we need to go back into the system. I could see how maybe that perception is, you know, kind of tipped towards that perspective because of. We're coming back.
Skewed because, maybe the parents, sometimes the parents putting their kids back in are putting them back in because they feel like, oh, we're not quite handling this properly. Let's put them back into
public
school.
Or the kid's not, because, I mean, it's equal. I guess I'd love to hear your guys' thoughts on homeschooling. The balance of the parent versus kid's responsibility.
But one other thing, though. So I was able to see it from the other side. Also, from the teacher.
Yes.
So I would, when I was working at South Florida Elementary, we would have homeschool kids that come back, and they're three grade levels behind in their reading. And so we would have to work to, you know, get them back. So I understand both sides of that.
Yeah.
But there are stereotypes in place.
And I think following up on that, too, even with what you shared, Kelly, so much of the decision we made or the basis for our decision was on what is working best for us as a family at this time, you know, and I think part of it was, you know, there were some fears, you know, honestly, going into junior high, that kind of thing, you know, and friends of ours had a difficult experience, you know, that kind of thing. And then John was in travel sports to where, you know, it was for us, it worked to have that time because then we could leave early to get him to Wilmington, you know. But then as we transitioned through that, you know, he decided he wanted to play for a school. He wanted, you know, something that homeschooling didn't have. He wanted, you know, organized sports. And so in a lot of cases, that was really what made the basis of our decision was based on what works best for us as a family right now.
Yeah.
And I think we benefited, if I may say so, from those early homeschoolers, you know, 10, 12 years ago, because I remember, you know, in that conversation at times, people would come directly up to me and say, oh, you have a problem with the school too, huh? You know, and it's like, no, we have no axe to grind here. You know,
no, I just have a problem with you.
You know, and I would explain it. This is what's working best as the options we have available.
Yes.
Thanks to those who have gone before us and made this a option. You know, this is what works best for us as a family. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, that's how we kind of came to that ebb and flow because Lizzie didn't homeschool as long as John did, but yet there was a year there where she did, and it just worked for us as a family. And I think, you know, I appreciate what you both share in that, and going ahead with what you were going to say from there, Mrs. P, sorry.
I was, Justin, remind me what your question was a minute ago.
It was a good one,
but I forgot what it was. When you were talking about, was the spectrum of homeschool?
No,
or
but you were,
the one I interrupted?
Parent-child role?
Yeah,
the balance
between parent and children responsibility.
That is a great question.
It is a great question. I mean, I would say, so from my experience, I'm homeschooling very young kids, so my responsibility is great. And so I can definitely see, as Raleigh, she'll be starting second grade this year. And so, like, even just last year, her ability to be independent was much greater than when she was in kindergarten. Mm. And so that was wonderful to be able to say, I'm going to expect you to do these things. But for the most part, you got to be pretty hands-on when they're that little. Mm-hmm. So what was y'all's experience when they were older?
Well, I would say one of the huge benefits of homeschooling is that growth of responsibility. Like, and it depends on the curriculum you choose, you too, but the curriculum we chose was very self-directed. And so the kids, you know, they'd have their things to do for every day, get them done. Sure. And they knew if they got them done in a decent amount of time, they would have some good free time to, you know. So I feel like that rhythm and routine and those choices that they had of how to spend their time as middle schoolers really prepared them for, you know, bigger decisions that would come later. Like, how are you going to spend your time as a high schooler or a young adult? And growing those skills early on, I think, is one of the big benefits of homeschooling.
I'd say it was more even like a Jeffersonian type dynamic, to where the kids were able to, you know, take on that leadership role for themselves.
And sometimes they make choices about what they were learning.
And based on classic, Chris did a fabulous job with that, as far as, you know, it was a lot of the education was based on classic literature, you know, and so forth. And that, you know, versus textbook type dynamic. We didn't have a textbook to speak of, you know, and I think there was, I think John has developed the love of reading. You know, I'm not saying that's because of his homeschooling experience, but I use that word, he developed, but I think Lizzie had that from early on, that she just loves to read. And I think that makes a difference too, you know, as a student, you know, just in that process and that the ability to self-teach at that point and, you know, take on that. Yeah.
And if we talk about early education, just backtracking a little bit, reading is the number one. And we're talking about reading from as early as you can. Reading in the womb. I can't stress enough just the lap reading and just the love of words.
Yes.
I think our culture is going away from that. And unfortunately, with technology, you can set up a kid with a book on their computer or on their iPad or whatever. But it's not the same as sitting on a lap and reading together and talking about the words. And I guess that's one of my, what do you,
passions,
yeah.
Pet peeves?
It is a little bit of a pet peeve when I see just kids sitting in front of technology. But even just the relationship, the parent-child relationship that's developed as you're reading together, it cannot be replaced.
Yep.
And if there's one thing that I would say to young parents is read.
Yeah.
And have the kids choose their books at the library. Yeah. Make library the best place to go every week. And
you'd be surprised too, like, as you're, if you're used to giving your kid devices and whatever, if you transition to this, like, I want to add to your encouragement to try this, because if you engage with them in a reading experience, you know, read a book to them or whatever, they'll prefer that to the device.
Mm.
Maybe not when you present it, but if you don't present it as an option, you say, hey, now before we go to bed, this is what we're doing.
I'm gonna do this.
Yeah, and I know you guys do this all the time, reading, and Jackson makes up stories.
Me
and,
too.
Which maybe doesn't count as reading, but certainly.
No, I was just, like, adding on to what Chris is saying about reading. Like, I can't echo that enough. Like, for us in our family, even though our kids are young, like, we try to read all the time, and we're like, right now we're reading through the Chronicles of Narnia. We're on The Last Battle, so we're on the final book. And what's super neat about it is we generally read it around the dinner table, and so we've been reading, obviously we've been reading for a while because there's a lot of books, but like Walter, my 3-year-old, will have very thoughtful things to say about Narnia, which is like amazing, right? Mm-hmm. Because Narnia is not written for 3-year-olds, you know, but he's like soaking it all in, and he'll like talk about a random character. In The Last Battle, there's a horse that's name is Jewel, and Justin's daughter's name is Jewel, and he just thinks it's hilarious, and so he'll talk about that, like Jewel the horse, you know. And but it's been so neat to see how he really is like following along with these very deep stories and these thoughtful things and just the conversations that come from it. And then just like the shared experience, yeah. like it's us all getting to be part of this great adventure together and like what's going to happen next. And, you know, like I think nothing's better than reading together. So,
and it makes me sad to think about families that are missing out on those rich experiences, like maybe because you're too busy. I mean, we've done the travel teams and the rushing off to practices, and and though that has benefit, I think, in my personal opinion, short-term benefit, just not being on that rush of going on to the next thing, it robs you when you're so busy. And I feel like those richer the richer experiences that Kelly just talked about, I wish we had more of those looking back. I mean, our kids are in their 20s, so I'm looking back from a different perspective. We're looking back like we loved the eras of each of the children's developmental stages. And looking back is like, I wish we had, and we did a lot of that, but I wish we had more.
I guess I'd be curious to hear what you guys think in terms of families who are busy, not because traveling teams, right? Like they have two working parents and they have to make those bills paid or whatever. And you know, they are missing out on rich experiences, but maybe not because they prefer that or they're choosing that. Like what would be some tips or tricks for that kind of that reading experience we're talking about? Even in that, like, do you have any thoughts about that? It's kind of on the spot, but
I mean, I would say, like, it's okay to, like, legitimately schedule it. Like, to say, like, hey, this is this day, this time, we're reading, you know? Like, and you don't need to start by saying, we're going to read every day. We're going to read every day for 30 minutes, you know? Like, to say, hey, on this day, we're going to read. We're going to read together for this amount of time. And I would say, sometimes maybe it would come across and feel like almost like a burden or like a chore, but I think as you commit to it, it will start to feel like a privilege and not like something you have to do, but something that you get to do.
An opportunity.
Yeah. And then also, like I would also say, I think social media makes this whole like read aloud thing seem so magical and beautiful. And it is magical and beautiful, but it also is like super chaotic. Like oftentimes Gibson is like standing up in his high chair, throwing his food around while Jackson's reading, and like we're trying, you know, like it's not this picture perfect beautiful like thing where everyone is always 100% engaged. And like what we've learned is we just kind of power through, because if we stopped at every single little hiccup and bump in our reading with four young kids, we're never going to read more than a, you know, a sentence really successfully. And so that would be too, like your expectations doesn't have to be high. You're not all going to sit under like a willow tree with the wind blowing your hair on a beautiful picnic blanket and like your kids staring lovingly into your eyes, you know, like that's not going to happen. And that's okay. Like it's okay to start small. And it's also okay to not, I mean, I think the whole family unit being together is wonderful and great to have that be the intention. But also, like, I have read-alouds that I'm doing with the kids just on my own because Jackson is at work. And so it's okay to say, you know, as the mom or the dad that is home more available in that season, to say, hey, this is going to be a read-aloud we do, you know, without dad or without mom right now while they're at work.
And I was honestly thinking about that, even from that perspective. Do you have, like, books you'd recommend, even? Just favorites of your families, I'm thinking of. Off the top of my head, was there any... I mean, you mentioned Narnia, and that's kind of what... But, you know, that might be... But for younger kids, I mean...
I got a great one.
You got a great one?
I know it's supposed to be about them, Mark.
You're doing great, Justin. Yeah. You're doing great.
I want to hear what Chris says, too, because I got to write down the book she says.
Go ahead. I want to hear Justin.
The one that we really love, and is a great one if you're not used to reading out loud, is the book with no pictures. Because it forces you to be silly. You can't, if you read it, you will be silly. You can read it as monotone as you want, and it will sound silly. And it's a good way to get the kids listening and engaged and... In our case, laughing hysterically out loud.
It is so funny.
It is great book.
And that's a book that would be read in one sitting very, very easily.
Yeah.
Which also, if you're starting out with reading aloud, might be nice to start with small books that you can finish. Because that might feel a little bit better and like more of an accomplishment. So, Chris, what do you have?
Well, I want to say when you're talking about the experience isn't always wonderful. Every book isn't always wonderful.
True.
Right?
Yeah.
So, unless I've read the books ahead of time, we're going into, you know, somebody else's recommendation, which may not be something that our family loves. So every book isn't going to be, oh, this is a wonderful story. Mark has a better memory than I do. So he could probably pull out a lot of the titles. But I know the 1 year we did American history through the, we taught American history with literature chronologically. So, you know, it went from early Native American all the way up through, and you've read a book about each era, which I loved. But some of our favorites were like Johnny Tremaine. That was a read aloud because it's a much higher reading level. Carry On, Mr. Bowditch. What were some other ones?
Across the Five Aprils.
All those are all historical fiction. So, but that isn't the only genre.
Yeah.
John, of course, loves like Narnia and like that. Not science fiction. It's not.
Yeah,
it's a more of a
fantasy.
And Lizzie and I are definitely more into the, you know, Lizzie and I just love to read, and so we can read anything. But we love the. Like, I love historical fiction. I think Lizzie does too. So, back to the original question a little bit ago was I really feel. I think the most difficult situation is the single parent, and that's my heart goes out to the single parent, because their choices are much diminished.
Yeah,
because you know they've got to work.
Mm-hmm.
So what options does a parent have? A single parent have is using the car time. We are huge fans of Adventures in Odyssey, which is another, it's like you pop in a, it's a Christian-based reader's theater. Anyway, our kids, we would travel for hours up and, you know, to our family in New York and pop in at Adventures in Odyssey, and we would all love it, even up into the teenage years, even now, right, Mark? I mean, I suppose if we get in the car, we can pop one in and still really enjoy it.
Yeah.
So, but it's a form of reading together or listening together, because we get to discuss it and laugh together.
It develops the imagination.
Vocabulary.
There's wonderful different people in that, and the vocabulary they use. Mm-hmm. It just
which is something the TV, I think, the visual, when you have the visual, it takes away from that imagination piece. Mm-hmm. So even though it's not reading per se, we're all listening to the same thing and all kind of.
Yeah, and there's discussion made. I think that's part of the beauty of the reading as well. You know, even from, I think you're having conversation or, you know, developing thought in such a way that says, okay, how do I communicate this? And I think that's a lot of it. And, you know, especially for the, you know, the single parent, I think to have those times when you're building that connection is helpful later on when, you know, it's difficult to have that communication, you know, from a parent-child dynamic. And what do I, you know, how do we address these difficult topics? And I think if we have that foundational, you know, time of reading together and interacting together, I think it helps. It's not going to make it perfect, of course, but yet we've established that relationship. You know, and that, I think that's beneficial as well.
And I just want to just put out there, even for adults, there have been anniversaries where Mark and I will go away and we'll just take a book and read the book while we're, I mean, those are some of, on our honeymoon, we read A Severe Mercy. I don't know if you've read that book, but it's, I put it on your to read list.
Not necessarily with your kids.
No, that was not a kid book, but I even think as a couple reading together it has so much value.
I will say this too, like for Raleigh, who's in second grade, like she's starting to read on her own now, and it's like so fun because she just is like in her world reading, and like the other day she's starting to read the American Girl books, which she's just loving, and she started Kirsten the other day, and she'd read like one or two pages, and she's holding her book, and she comes up to me and she says, "Mommy, I have only read for like 3 minutes and I already love her." And it was just, and then she just marched back off to keep reading, and I was just like, oh my word, like, one, you're so cute, but also just like, how cool, like, she's already feeling this connection to this character, and so I think that's so cool. A couple of things I would say for reading, like, recommendations, Narnia for sure, especially if your kids are, like, I would say kindergarten and up, that would be awesome. And then we've loved, it's called The Wingfeather Saga, it was written by Andrew Peterson, he's an artist, and he, like, that is very Narnia-esque, but it's not, where Narnia is written a little bit more, I guess, old English-y kind of way. Like, it's maybe a little bit harder to read and comprehend. Wingfeather is not quite that way. We love Wingfeather. We think it's just amazing in our house. And then we also have been loving reading Little House on the Prairie. So the girls and I and the boys have been reading that at lunchtime. And we're loving that, too. So.
Cool.
I was thinking about the reading stuff too, and it, especially single parents or whatever, because again, that is a tough thing. I think I had a good conversation with someone recently about trying to get their kid to read more. Well, before I say that, I was going to say,
what were you going to say?
There's a big bug on the wall. That's what I was going to say.
I've actually been watching it the entire podcast. It started over here, crawled all the way around.
Like, he's like, I'm just waiting for the right question here. All right, Mark took care of business. There has never been a parent who has regretted forcing their kid to read. And I mean force, right? And so they might not be into it. They might not, like Kelly was saying, setting realistic expectations. Your kid might not be into reading. But if that's a required part of what they have to do in order to X, in order to, you know, stay up, in order to watch their favorite show or have a device, right? Like, if you want that device, then you have to put in 15 minutes of reading time or whatever. Like, anchoring it against some of those things that they do want to do, saying, you can do that thing, but first you have to put it. You'll never regret it. There's never been a parent who regretted forcing their kid to read, and there's never been a kid who looked back on his life and said, I wish I would have read less, right? So this is something you can do in any walk of life as a parent, and no matter what your schooling preference is, right? Like, if you're high school, homeschool, you know, whatever, charter school, no matter which version of that, they still need to learn to love to read. And again, love is a high expectation. That comes over time. They still need to learn to read as a form of education, as a form of
entertainment. That is a universal tenet of education. Reading.
Yes, thank you.
Like, you want to score well on your SATs? It's linked to how early you read, how often you read, how many books you read every year. I mean, all of that, all of your academic success, and maybe even life success, if you want to put it kind of more general terms, is going to come back to reading.
And I think I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying at the first, but it does remind me of kind of that era. And I think there's something to be said for inspiring versus requiring. You know, I think as for my child, and I didn't always do this well, but for my child to develop a love of reading to a certain degree, it's more important that I inspire them to do that, you know, in that process.
And maybe even model it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Ultimately, as a model, you know, is like, well, if reading's so important, why aren't you? Yeah. You know, because that's what a kid is going to say. You know, initially, it's like, why is this so important? And why do I have to do it if you're not doing it? If you're sitting down watching TV for 3 hours, why can't I do that? You know, and I think
it's a great point. Yeah.
It's just, you know, and I it's not only in mine, you know, it's part of that Jefferson type thing, you know, to where it's like that leadership, you know, it's not about, you know, the professor, it's about ownership of your own, you know, the teacher necessarily. But yeah, it's just that, that was one tenet, was that inspire versus require. And I think, you know, that's who we all like tend to look to, as those people. And even when you were talking about Treehouse, you know, yes, you ladies, I think that was so much of your ability to connect with parents and kids, was you were involved in the process, you know, and join me and help me and that kind of thing, that creates that inspiration to learn more.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think that's helpful. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, we, as parents, we need to be modeling yeah. those, you know, how important it is. But yeah.
And
did you have anything?
No, go ahead. Keep going. I wanted to get back to what Justin, you were going to say ahead. Something about somebody, you were talking to somebody who wanted to get their children to read more.
Actually, as I recall the conversation, it was about bedtimes. And I was mm-hmm. telling him, what you can do is rather than move their bedtime up, is say, you don't have to go to bed earlier, mm-hmm. but you have to be in your room and you have to be mm-hmm. reading.
Sure.
So now, because I think their struggle was like, then they want to stay up and watch whatever, mm-hmm. what, you know, just, they wanted them to get settled sooner or whatever. And I said, well, what we would do is we would say, you can stay up as late as you want, but you got to be reading, you know. Mm-hmm. And, you know, naturally that makes you a little bit sleepy at the end of the night. If, you know, say they're not going to stay up all night. And if they stay up all night reading, I got no problem with that. It's never happened.
There is a current challenge, though, that, so I teach middle schoolers now. I think there is a challenge of quality literature for middle schoolers and high schools in particular, because there's a lot of stuff out there right now that is just putting forth agendas that you don't want your kids to fill their minds with all the time. Yes. And so I think early on, like, you know, up through fifth grade, we've got so many great choices of classics and just fun. But once you get to that middle school era, it's hard to find good literature for kids. And I think as a parent, you really do need to be in touch with what they're reading, what they're filling their minds with. Read the reviews. I mean, there are different websites that you can go to that will kind of give you a summary of what the book is about and, you know, all of that. So it makes me sad that we don't have more really great literature for middle schoolers. But I think as parents, we need to be aware. We need to know.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, even with little kid books, like, there's a lot of books right now that I will pick up at the library because it looks cute, and I'll read a couple pages in, and I'm like, oh my, like, we can't read this book. Like, so even the library books that we pick up at the library, I'll generally let the kids pick a few, and then I'll have, like, a little list of what I grab. And, like, when we get home, I have to read through all the little kid books that Raleigh and Lenore picked to make sure Raleigh's not going to read them and read something that she shouldn't be reading. Like, that's in little kid picture books at the library, you know? That there's stuff in those, you know? And then also I would say too, like,
how do you make that decision as a mother? Just out of curiosity, I hear you say stuff in them. How do you mind sharing how you personally kind of vet a book?
Yeah. I mean, I would say for me right now, and I don't know if you've noticed this or anything, but like in young kid books now, there's a lot of like LGBT things and like agendas being pushed in that of, you know, like here's this home with two dads, or here's this, you know, this, this donkey that thinks they're a unicorn and it's going to be true to himself and he's going to become a unicorn and this is what he's going to do that. And it's like, that is like, it, you know, like those sorts of things that I'm like, okay, like this is, seems like it's harmless, but it's really not. And so for me, I mean, I'm following, I guess, the morals that I have and that I hold to, and what I wouldn't want to be reading that even myself, like a book that is filled with these things. And so I'm going to hold that to the same with my kids and protect their heart and their eyes the same way I would with a show, you know, like I wouldn't have them go watch a show with this kind of content. So why would I have them, you know, read a book? But it's crazy to think that you really have to check everything because like even the little kid picture books at the library, like, if it's newer, you definitely need to check it.
that's what I was thinking.
The older ones, you generally don't. Like, if I look at one and I see how that it looks pretty old, I'm like, that was probably fine. Like, Raleigh, we can read this out loud together right now, as opposed to me, like, pre-reading. But yeah, and then also I'd say, like, what Chris was saying about as they get older, like, good literature, like, as far as it being, I think, clean and having good content, but also, like, just being good, like, well-written. Like, there's so much stuff that I've, when I'm reading it, I'm like, what are we reading right now? Like, this isn't even well thought out or well written for them to be able to, like, grow in their I guess their language skills and things. Like, I feel like it's not enriching. It's just kind of blah, you know? Mm-hmm. And so that too, there's a book called, it's called Honey for a Child's Heart. And in the book, the author talks a lot about just the value of reading at the beginning, but then she has really amazing book lists. And like, I'll bring that book when I go to book sales. So I'm like, okay, is this on her book list? And I really trust this person's judgment because every book I've gotten from her book lists, I've really enjoyed. And so that could be a cool thing if you're a parent listening and you're like wanting to start building a library that has really quality things. It's Honey for a Child's Heart. It's nice. A good one.
That's awesome. I was also going to say in the show notes, we'll include some of these books and I'll hit you guys up afterwards for like your favorite books. Cause I think that'd be a great resource to be able to offer
people
specifically different age. And like, you even talked about historical books, like that would naturally make the list for me, but maybe it should, right?
That's cool.
So yeah, it'd be great to provide that at the end.
And the other thing is somebody recently was asking me about reading with their children. Their children was behind in the testing for the year. And so she was picking books to read with her children. I'm like, well, what you want to do is choose a book that's slightly more difficult, like not frustration level, not independent level. It's called instructional level. So you kind of have to know where your child is on that whole spectrum of there's different ways you can do this online. You can give them a little test and figure out what reading level they're at. But if you want to improve, let's say through the summer, you want to improve your child's reading level, you got to figure out where they are, and that's an alphabetical scale. Like, okay, they're a K or a J. You want to give them one level ahead of where they really are. Because if you go too easy, it's really not increasing their reading ability. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of making things too easy. And I'll find that, like, when I worked, I taught fourth and fifth grade for a while, and I found that a lot of the boys especially liked a certain series of books. But it was way below their reading level. And so, you know, it was really a difficult thing to not only find a good book with good content, good vocabulary, well-written, good morals, but also is the right reading level. Like, that is, it's just really a science and really hard to do the best for your child in choosing the books. I think that's a real challenge.
Yeah. And so there are tools for that, though.
There are tools.
So again, that'd be good. Maybe afterwards, I can get with you to get that for the show notes. Because, yeah, tools. Any tools we can give people to help on this journey, childhood education, right? Because that's what I mean. Really, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about reading. To bring it back to the topic, that is, I think we're all saying one of the most significant drivers of your childhood's education is if you can incorporate significant amounts of reading, right?
And I think it stretches across all homeschool, charter school, public school, whatever you do, all ages, reading is always something that can be parent-driven. No matter who's instructing your child, you can guide them in this way. Like, that's important for everybody. Like, if your kid goes to public school, it's not like, oh, good, my kid goes to public school, I don't have to worry about that. Like, they've got it. Like, well, no, like, you can also play a huge role in this specific area, no matter what your child, you know, is doing right now for schooling. So
I think one of the other, this is kind of going down a different tangent, but one of the other skills or things that parents really need to think about is who you're putting in your child's life. I'm saying, like, role models, or I was reading an article by Tim Elmore recently about how intergenerational relationships used to be so rich and deep when you had the schoolhouse that had multiple ages in it, and when you had grandparents investing into, you know, when you had, this is nothing against children's ministry with children going a different direction, but when you have a church with the children in the church with you, you know, years ago they didn't have like children's programs and whatnot, like everybody was learning together, the intergenerational value is good. And so I think that's another thing maybe we've lost in this era that we're in is, you know, keep your kids with their same age group because that's how they learn best. I think homeschool has kind of push that back a little bit, because you are, like classical conversation, you are learning with different age groups, so to speak. But you, I think as a parent, you have to be very intentional about growing that skill, that social skill with your kids, that they can relate to a person of any age. Like, they're not only comfortable with people who's their age.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, again, a parent, you need to just think about that and be intentional about putting people into your children's life who are different age groups, different, have different experiences. Because there's not only education in the school sense, and I'm using air quotes there, in the school sense, you're educating your child all the time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All the time. There's emotional intelligence. There is, you know, the academic intelligence.
Yeah.
There's your spiritual intelligence. All of these things feed into who your child is becoming.
Hey, thank you for listening to our podcast. If you like How I See It, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us, and or talk nicely about us on social media. If you want to reach out, the email is us@howiseeit.click. Yep, I said dot click, as in dot C-L-I-C-K. Please tell your friends about this show, and we'll see you on the next one.